Hello, just before the podcast begins, I want to tell you about The Assassination. It's a new podcast series from the BBC World Service. My name's Owen Bennett-Jones, and I used to be the BBC's correspondent in Pakistan, and for years covered the story of one of the world's best-known politicians, Benazir Bhutto. Then she was assassinated. The Assassination is all about my 10-year investigation into what happened. There are already 7 episodes with more to come. Search for The Assassination wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Ed Butler and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. How much are you putting aside for your declining years?
I'm not saving for old age.
You don't give it a moment's thought?
I thought about it, but I'm not doing anything. I just have the feeling it's very difficult.
Yes, if we could deal with rainy day saving, many of the world's health and social crises might be resolved. So why are we so bad at it? An expert on money and behaviour speaks out.
We have to deal with it better. We have to think about what do we spend on now and how do we separate between spending now and spending later.
That's all to come in Business Daily from the BBC. How good are you at saving for a rainy day? Apparently, 8 of the world's major economies will, between them, have a shortfall of some $400 trillion over the next 30 years. That's for pension provision. The assumption here is that most of us need about 70% of our working income to get by in our retirement. But the shortfall that the experts at the World Economic Forum have come up with is a staggering 5 times the size of all of the world's stock markets. I'll just give you a moment to pause and reflect on that. The experts believe the solution needs to come from many different sources. But first and foremost, we all simply need to roll our sleeves up and start putting money away, even during the early years of our working lives. Germans, for one, are supposed to be quite good at this sort of thing. At least that's the archetype. But here's a couple we've found who aren't. Economics students Christoph and Eileen. They both acknowledge they're saving nothing towards their retirement.
I would say no, not really. Nah.
No. No, I'm not saving for old age.
You don't give it a moment's thought?
I thought about it, but I'm not doing anything. I just have the feeling it's very difficult.
What they say is just like a fraction of 1% or 1%. That could make, you know, it all adds up over decades.
That's true. I should do that. I know that. My mom tells me all the time, but I didn't do it yet. Maybe we should consult some insurances on making this easier for young people.
Well, one man who is looking at how we might change this is the celebrated economist and author Dan Ariely. He's a globally renowned behavioural economist. He's based at Duke University in the US and has been studying some of the simple human tricks that perhaps might nudge us towards a more prudent approach. When I spoke to him, he began by looking at why we're so poor to begin with at handling our own finances.
The thing that we need to recognise about money is that we have to deal with it better. We have to think about what do we spend on now and how do we separate between spending now and spending later. And here's a really difficult problem. One of the main challenges in behavioral economics is that the environment matters. We don't just act based on our preferences. The decisions is a function of the environment around us. And the environment is everything. It's every coffee shop and every app on your phone and everything on your computer. Now, think to yourself, who in your environment cares about your long-term well-being?
Hopefully my wife.
Hopefully your wife, although I heard somebody saying that the key to a successful marriage is to have life insurance, but not too much.
You could be right.
So your wife, maybe kids, parents. But we have to recognize that not many entities are on our side. And then on the other side, who wants to get your money, time, and attention?
Most people.
Most entities, right? Every coffee shop, every app, Facebook. And what we need to recognize is that they want quarterly earnings rather than want your long-term well-being, right? You care about where you'll be in 20 years. They care about where they'll be in quarters. So we have to recognize that the world is not neutral. The world is basically designed to try and take things from us. And there was this terribly sad analysis. In the US, every person that dies, they analyze what did they die from. And in particular, what is the likelihood that we would accelerate our death? What's the likelihood that we would make a mistake that will lead to our early mortality? And they realized that the percentages used to be about 10, and now they're about 43. What happened? Why are we killing ourselves more? It's not because we became more stupid. It's because we have more temptation.
Sorry, temptation killed us?
Yes.
How did temptation kill us?
Obesity, diabetes, smoking, texting and driving. All of those are temptations, right? If you think about food, the temptation industry, in terms of tempting us to eat more than we need, has improved dramatically.
This is a very grey picture, or rather depressing picture, of the world you're painting for me. But I mean, temptation has its rewards, doesn't it?
Temptation is about something that is short-term good for us. If somebody says, I want to have one potato chip a day, I don't think any of us would mind. But the problem is that the people who sell potato chip don't want you to end at one a day.
They're not selling moderation.
Yes. Lots of entities want our money. They're making it hard for us to think about long-term. Imagine you work between age 30 to 65, that's 35 years, and then you live between age 65 to 85, that's 20 years. You have lots of years to save for, right? If you died at 65, life would be much simpler. But if you plan to live for 20 more years, it means that for every year of work, you need to basically save for half a year at retirement, or maybe even more. We've looked at people at their older age who are running out of money. And it's not just running out of money. It's the constant state of worry. And we did some interviews with retirees. And they were doing terrible things, like they were cutting their medications into half to try and prolong their money a little bit. They were not going to movies. They were doing all kinds of things that are not substantial saving, but substantial decrease in the quality of their lives.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, famously, people are very poor at preparing for their retirement. Tell me about how we attempt to tackle that.
I'll tell you about one study that was very important for me in terms of figuring out how to do this. And this was a study we did in Kenya in a slum called Kibera. And we were trying to get very poor people to save a bit of money. And this is not saving for retirement. There's no retirement in their future. These people die at a relatively young age. But it's a rainy day saving. Because here's what happened. If you're very poor and you live hand to mouth, you have no access. And one day something bad happens. Maybe you had a goat and the goat gave you 25% of your income. And one day your goat is sick. What happens now? You borrow. In Kibera, you borrow at about 10% a week. And let's say that 4 weeks later, your goat is healthy. Great news, but now you're 4 weeks behind plus interest, right? Really hard to get out of it. So maybe you sell a lantern or a bucket or something, or gain worse and worse debt. And this is what happens to the poor the world over. The financial system really abuses them. So we said, how do we help them save a little bit of money? And the first principle was to say, let's use friction. Let's create a system where it's easy to put money in, but hard to get it out. So we teamed up with M-Pesa, the online payment company in Kenya, and we teamed up with an investment bank. And people put money into their M-Pesa account, and every night it moved to the investment bank. And what that meant is you couldn't take it back through M-Pesa. You had to take a bus, go to the city, fill a form, wait an hour, take a bus back.
Right, because M-Pesa is mobile payments, but the bank is obviously good old-fashioned analog payments.
That's right. Yeah. So it could take you maybe 4 or 5 hours. And that was by design, easy in, hard out. That was the first system, and we gave that system to lots and lots of people. And then we added things to it. Some people just got that system, the control condition. Some people got that system plus a weekly reminder that said, try and save 100 shillings, about a dollar this week. Some people got the same message, but it was framed as if it came from their kids. Try and save 100 shillings. Hi, dad. Hi, mom. This is little Joseph, whatever the name of the kid was. We knew the name of the kids. Try and save 100 shillings this week for the future of our family.
Behavioral economist Dan Ariely here on Business Daily. More from him in a moment. But before we hear his results to those tests, we thought we'd do something similar ourselves. A quick reminder of those options again. One, have the bank make withdrawing your savings a little harder than depositing them. Two, same again, but with a weekly text reminder from the bank to save. And option three, an additional reminder, but this time it comes from your children. Well, we asked some randomly selected Kenyans in Nairobi how they'd react to such encouragement to save.
If my bank made it harder to withdraw, they are very serious that I won't withdraw. I'll save at home. It's your money. Nobody should limit you from your money. So when they tell you, this is your money, yes, but I will determine when you're going to take it. No, you can't agree.
I think getting a message from my bank telling me thank you, I'd be very, very happy, and it will encourage me more to save.
If I get a message from my children or my family asking me to save, I'll think twice. But from my bank, I'll not be that serious because I know they are looking for profits.
if the government give me a bonus for me because of saving, it would encourage me a lot and encourage also others to save.
Some enthusiastic responses there, some less so. But what did Dan Ariely find when he did his experiment? Bonuses? Familial texts? What's the right answer? Back to Dan.
What happened is that when an adult thinks about their kids, right, it's a text message from the kids, hi mom, hi dad, save, we become more idealistic. And actually, if you think about lots of behavioral change, kids have been instrumental in the anti-smoking campaign, seatbelts, all kinds of things. So we become more idealistic. As a breadwinner, when do you get positive feedback from your family? When you bring stuff. The kids say, thank you, significant other, whatever it is, you get positive feedback. Every time you put money away in insurance or savings, you get no positive feedback. And the coin was our way of saying, let's get the whole family to recognize that this is happening. There was a very sad study recently that looked at lottery winners. And they basically asked the question, what happens to the people who live next to the people who win the lottery? And you know what happened?
No, tell me.
They start spending more money. And some of them start spending so much more money that they go bankrupt. And the reality is that the world over, we compete on spending. We can't compete on saving because it's invisible. So another thing that we find is that budgets are wonderful, but miserable. So if you kept a perfect budget, life would be better, but you would be miserable every moment. It's like counting calories.
It's not exciting, is it?
It actually makes everything more miserable. Like if you count calories, you don't enjoy any meal. If you have a budget and every time you go to get a cup of coffee, you think about where does it fit with your budget, life is just not worth living, right? So we find that a good intermediate spot is to have a budget for all your discretionary spending.
Yeah, I remember once it was a kind of a Buddhist exercise, I think it was, to actually just to invite everybody in a large room to know precisely the coin value of what was in their pocket at any given moment, which is a wonderful thing. It's like kind of meditating upon your own mortality every day. I'm sure it's very good for the spirit, but it does seem rather an onerous responsibility to know precisely how many coins you're carrying at any second.
That's right. So one idea is to basically say, don't worry about the details to that degree. Just create an overall account for everything that is discretionary, alcohol, going out, taxes, and so on. Now, what's the time frame? It turns out 1 month is way too long. People run out very quickly. It turns out a weekly is the right amount. And do you think it's better to start the week on Monday or on Friday?
Well, I go with Monday. I suppose I'm an old-fashioned person in that regard.
No, you're actually right. It's not. What happens is if you start on Friday, you basically burn too much money on the weekend, and then you run out.
Good.
And if you run out on Wednesday, you're not going to not eat anything. And if you start on Monday, you save some of the money for the weekend. And then if you need to adjust, the weekend is a really good time to adjust because you have more flexibility. So the thing we've tried is to get people to have money on a prepaid debit card.
Oh, yes. So there is no credit. Essentially, you only can spend as much as in there.
That's right. And with some of the new debit cards, you can get a morning reminder of how much money is on the card. And you basically have a short horizon. It's not the optimal way to deal with money, but it's a simple heuristic that helps us think better about money and behave better about money. I'll tell you one other thing we did. We did something we call spending buddies. We got women to agree to meet each other once a month and go over their credit card bills together and justify each item. And after one time,
That sounds divisive.
And after they did it once, the voice of their friends started playing in their ears as they were buying things, and it did change. It did change behavior. The whole point is to get us to be a bit more. I don't want people to be miserable, right? Life is about being happy with some constraints of financial. I mean, it would be terrible if people start being so stingy that they would basically not enjoy life and just try to die with more money. But at the same time, we have to devise some tools to help us think more about the long term and spend better. One final study. We went into people's checking account and we pulled their transaction and we asked them, to what extent do you regret each of those? Because usually when you buy something, you're future looking, you're forward looking. How happy will this make me? But we don't really ask ourselves, how happy did it make me? And what do you think was the category that people regretted the most?
I don't know, clothing?
Going out for dinner. And it's not because going out for dinner is a bad thing, but because when we go out for dinner, we end up eating too much and drinking too much, and then we regret the experience.
And we have no, I suppose, very little to show for it a day later.
Actually, hangover and sometimes feeling bloated.
Wise words there from Dan Ariely, and a sentiment shared by those two German students we heard from earlier from the London School of Economics.
Sometimes it happens that you get into situations where you do spend more money on food or going out or doing things where you then next day think, why did I actually spend that much money on that? Sometimes it's also nice to consciously say, okay, tonight I go to a nice restaurant or I do go out with friends, and then you spend money and then it's fine. But then I don't really regret it that much. I'm not like the next day crying about it.
And also what's so nice about going out and maybe drinking and eating is the social aspect of it. I think that's why so many people do it. That's what's fun about it. And that's so we find alternatives for that. So we just don't go out and drink any there, but we meet at your place, at my place.
Okay, here's a question. Would you spend less if you had a friend who sat with you once a month looking at your checking account and what had gone in and got out?
Well, we would laugh a lot when we would do that, I think. I think it could have the influence that I be more conscious about my spendings.
Yes, I agree totally.
So there you are, a couple of tips that might just get you started spending less and saving more. Remember, there is no better time to start than right now. Any saving tips you want to share with us, do send them to world.business@bbc.co.uk or tweet me directly at edbutler2. We'd love to hear from you. Well, that's almost it for this edition of Business Daily. But first, a final thought from the behavioural economist and expert on all things money, Dan Ariely.
Imagine I gave you £20 and I said, what's the best use? Like, how would you use it to maximise the quality of your life? So I'll tell you what the most common answer is. Buy your wife flowers. On average, how many times a year do you buy your wife flowers?
Two.
And a good year.
It's a shame, right? It's one of those things that is incredibly cheap to buy, create a lot of happiness. And one thing that also happens is that they also increase the propensity to have sex. And it turns out
there's a return on my £20.
And the return is longer than you expect it. Because for how long do you think couples feel better about each other after having sex? Like, how much did this after sex glow last? How many hours?
Minutes? Three.
51.
51 hours?
51 hours on average.
Who knew that?
There's research. So some people know it. But if you think about this, right, these flowers could have a long-term return.
The things you learn on Business Daily. Dan Ariely's latest book with co-author Jeff Kreisler is called Small Change, Money, Mishaps and How to Avoid Them. Do check it out. Fascinating stuff. You can check us out. Same time tomorrow. Take care.